This is Vulnerability Matters from the Money Advice Trust. Hello, hello. Welcome back to Vulnerability Matters. I'm Chris Fitch. In our last episode, one of the UK's most prolific scammers, Alex Wood, explained how he stole millions of pounds from consumers and businesses. So in this episode, we're going to look at the other side of the coin as we hear an equally compelling story from mother and daughter, Lynn and Lou, about how Lynn lost money to a scammer just like Alex. And like many stories, this all starts with a phone ringing one night. It's Lynn's bank on the line, but it isn't actually Lynn's bank. It's a scammer. And within an hour of Lynn putting the phone down, £600 had been spent on Royal Mint coins, a £6,000 loan in her name had been put into motion, and what was until then a quiet night in front of the telly was suddenly left shattered and in total disarray. But what followed next was, in Lynn's words, even worse than the scam itself. While the money was stopped, Lynn experienced brittle exchanges with her bank, a subsequent change of provider, and then wave after wave of fresh attempts to defraud her as Lynn's details were traded freely among scammers. But there's a twist in a tale. Lynn is the mother of Lou Baxter, MBE, who leads the National Trading Standard Scams team. And this proves undoubtedly that anyone, even someone where fraud is in the family in the right way, can be affected by scams like this. So, after some words from our sponsor, join us as we relive through Lynn and Lou's eyes the very human, now very common, and utterly destabilizing effects of being scammed in the UK today.
The FCA is clear. You must show that vulnerable customers get equally good outcomes. Learn how in our Outcomes and Vulnerability course on the 28th of January. Sign up at moneyadvicetrust.org/vulnerability.
Lynn and Lou, thanks ever so much for joining us. It's really, really appreciated. So we'll start with you, Lynn. Lynn, if someone were meeting you for the first time, how would you describe yourself?
A short, older lady, I think. Quite smiley, but you can't get away from your height thing, and you can't get away from the grey hair and the fact that I'm an older lady. But normally quite smiley, quite nice, quite pleasant.
And Lynn, how would you introduce or describe Lou? What do you make?
She's very fierce, but she's also short, but quite well known these days because of her the job that she does. So she appears on podcasts, she appears on stages. She is quite well known in her field.
She's very well known. So let's take us, Lynn, back to the experience that we're here to discuss, and we really do appreciate this. So take us back to the very beginning. What happened? What was the first contact?
It was a phone call. About 6:15 in the evening, when you've sort of settled your brain down and remembering I always dealt with a bank that only ever you dealt with on the phone. You never saw a person. They have no branches. So it was only phones. And the gentleman who phoned me said, "We've noticed that there has been strange activity on your bank account." Immediately gives you panic. So consequently, he then went through a whole, and he was charming. He was kind, considerate, "Don't worry about the time, we've got plenty of time," et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. He said there had been this unauthorised act. I'd apparently spent £600 on coins from the Royal Mint at that time. That was the one item that they were phoning me up about to see if I had made this purchase. So, you know, we went through lots and lots of things. He knew what my bank account, he knew what standing or direct debits I'd got on my account. He knew everything about the bank account that we were discussing. He didn't ask me to give him any password, but would I go onto my bank account and do certain things on my bank account? I never gave him anything speaking to him. I just did it on my computer. Then we put the phone down. And I thought, I don't know. I wasn't comfortable. I should have been comfortable, but I wasn't comfortable. So instead of phoning my expert, I phoned my other daughter. So Emily then said, "You should phone your bank, mother, to check this. Use the normal phone," which I duly did. Mm-hmm. And the lady on the phone there said, "We'll put a stop on your account." So the next morning, I phone through again and get through to the fraud department, where I met up with a man who might need another job. I don't know. He was vile. That's the only word I can use for him. He was absolutely horrible. I understand it's his job and he has to make sure that the claim that you're making is correct. But he only had to look at my previous banking history. And the fact by then I'd taken out a £6,000 loan on my account because he said I'd done that. He also said
I'd the criminals taking out a loan in mum's name when they'd accessed her account and they'd bounced the loan money into her account, but the bank had stopped it before the criminals were able to take it out.
And then he said, but you gave them everything. I said, I gave them nothing. I said, I was phoned by somebody purporting to be from your bank. I said, and by now, of course, you are really distressed. Because you've got somebody on the end of the phone who is telling you, you have done this thing and you're going to be liable for a loan of £6,000 plus £600 that has come out of your account to go to the Royal Mint to buy coins. And you can't get through to this man that what you're telling him is the truth and you haven't done this. But he was so horrible. He made me feel worse than the scammer had. The scammer, all right, might have scammed me. But he was pleasant about it. The man from the bank was not in any way pleasant.
So in the course of 12 hours or so, Lynn, you'd gone from just taking a phone call to within an hour, I think, of that conversation you had with the scammer, them applying for a £6,000 loan, which was then put into your account. And they also purchased a number of Royal Mint coins.
Yeah.
So... And then you have the encounter with the bank where you feel very much under suspicion. You describe the gentleman as kind of vile. And you're in a position where you don't have any money, everything's frozen, and you can't get on with everyday life. That's really tricky. And in a moment, I'm going to ask you what you did next, what the next steps. But Lou, where did you come into this? Obviously, Lynn phoned her favourite daughter. Lou, where did you come into this, and how common is an experience like Lynn's?
So Emily phoned me, my sister phoned me and told me about it. So and we spoke about it in the morning, and I went through everything, the text message, all of the information, and I was like, okay, this is an imposter scam. But at the moment, we weren't necessarily dealing with the practicalities of the scam at the particular moment, because mum. I'll say this about her, as you say, it's not one for getting upset particularly. We're quite hardy and resilient in our family. So if somebody's getting upset, there's usually a reason for it. There was a lot of language from mum that was, I'm stupid. I can't believe I've done this. I should have known better. Ashen, she was particularly ashen. So we sort of went through the emotional response to it initially, because that was more pressing. Because from a legal perspective and from a scams perspective, I was aware it was an imposter scam and that we would be able to fight to get her money back and get the loan reinstated and the money back from the mint to get that refunded. But it wasn't nice to see. But how common is it? £10 billion a year is lost to the UK economy through scams and fraud. It's something like 37% of us are responding to scams. So, and it's not the typical, and I mean this in the kindest way, this isn't the typical scam victim. The statistics are showing it's the 25 to 35-year-olds. So it's not, historically, we've always gone, people that get scammed are old, or people that get scammed are vulnerable. It isn't that. There is a scam out there for everybody. So it's particularly prevalent and common at the moment.
But I also believe that lots of my age people wouldn't tell you about it, because we're too embarrassed to tell you about it. We'd have looked at that and thought, yeah, the £6,000 loan, maybe not. They'd have written off if they'd have got the £600, they'd have written it off.
Yeah. It's a very common reaction, though, Lynn, to feel embarrassed about this. But, I mean, what happened next? What was the next step after you'd spoken to the gentleman at the bank?
They reinstated the £600. They reinstated They cancelled the loan, apart from the fact that the loan agreements continued to come to my house by post. So although they've told you that there is no loan, and you can see on your bank account because you only ever deal with them on the internet, you know, it's an internet banking, you deal with them that way, you've still got the loan papers coming to you. So there's still that little doubt. Has somebody still, you know...
It took a few days, though. It wasn't instant. They didn't refund you instantly.
And then I changed my bank account.
Okay.
So you moved providers because she moved of the provider. Treatment.
I could not, in all honesty... It was probably a month or so, but I had to change my bank. I'd have gone to any bank, I'd have put the money under the bed.
So this wasn't the end of the contact, though. There was waves and ripples that followed
on from
this. Oh,
I have scammed so many times, it's not true, by different things that you don't sign up to, like social media. You know, that they're sending you adverts and they're encouraging you to buy things which are never going to be true. But because... You still got that. Yeah, you have to. You don't buy anything. You don't go anywhere. You don't pick up the phone. I had one this week which was told me somebody had made a payment of £900 in my account.
Mum's now been added to a suckers list, which is the term the criminals use, which is the list that they use to target individuals. So once you have been susceptible to fraud or scams or responded to it, you get added to a list which the criminals then traffic and sell. So they're selling mum's details on, so then she's on a list where she's being continually retargeted, because you're also highly susceptible to being a victim of fraud if you've been a victim once. People generally can respond again.
Wave after wave of scams, approaches, links.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So what Lou, what when someone tells us about an experience like this, maybe thinking about this from both the perspective of family members, but also organizations, because I know you advise a lot of organizations on not just knowledge about scams and fraud, but also about how they might respond. What should we be doing for in our first conversation and response? What should we say and what should we not say, do you think?
So the language we use around fraud and scams is a bone of contention for me, because you would never say you fell for a mugging, but we quite often say you fell for a scam. We also use language like, oh, you lost money. Well, you didn't lose it. It was stolen from you. So the first thing I would do and try to do is the no blame, no shame. So the language we have to use has to put the heat on the feet of the criminals, not on the victim. We've done some research in the scams team about the similarity between the treatment of domestic abuse victims and scams and fraud victims. A lot of the language we use is blaming that victim for the things that have happened to them. It's also really important, without scaring people, that they understand they've been a victim of a crime, because the word scams is also a little bit like jolly or a bit del boy. So it's trying to emphasise the fact that you haven't done anything, you've been a victim of a crime. So if I was mugged on the street, I'd probably get a police response. And that wouldn't be, what, is that my fault for walking down the street? So no, it's not. So it's trying to shift the narrative, as much empathy as you possibly can. If you have been scammed or you've received a scam, try to empathise, explain that you understand why you could be susceptible. There's also, and I know we talk about this all the time, that situational vulnerability. People are not vulnerable. It's the situation or the marketplace they're trying to engage with that causes that vulnerability or susceptibility. So it's, listen, plain language, and ensure that all of the emphasis is on the criminals that have targeted your loved one or the person you're speaking to, and actually acknowledging the seriousness of the crime. It's not something silly or trivial. That victim, and they are a victim, needs to be treated as such and given the right support to ensure that they don't become re-victimised.
Yeah. And Lynn, you were saying earlier on, that you understood that you needed to be asked some questions by the gentleman at the bank you were with originally.
Well, I did.
Yeah.
I was fully prepared to answer all of the questions, because I wanted to get the account back up and running, and I wanted to ensure that I hadn't been liable for the £600 or the loan, both of which were still stood on my account. And I got no bank account at that time. So I was very, very prepared to give him any help I possibly could, but it was the way he asked the questions and the way he kept emphasising to me that I had done this thing, I had done it.
So Lou and Lynn, it's thinking about those, the people listening to our conversation will be thinking, okay, this is the response following a scam or a fraud is really, really important in terms of tone and what we think about and what we do. But in terms of maybe starting with Lou, what do we look and listen for in conversations with our clients or our customers that might indicate that actually someone is experiencing or has just experienced something like this? And what can we do to then step in and start a conversation about this?
It can be really complicated because this can be, if you think about emotional abuse and coercive control, which is now recognised as a domestic abuse offence, the criminals use the same tactics in a fraud and scams perspective, and that relationship could have gone on for a long time. It could be a one-time wonder, or it could be a really long relationship. If you think about romance fraud or pig butchering, which is a horrible term, but those sort of scams that go on for a really long time where you believe you're actually in a relationship with somebody. So there are things that you can listen for, things like, oh, my new friend. Who's your new friend? Should we talk about your new friend? There can sometimes be some self-neglect. Some of the victims that I deal with, now I tend to focus on the victims that are 70 plus. That's my victim support packages that we look at generally, because of the nature of the scams I deal with, generally telephone scams and mail scams, which is targeted at that demographic. And that's where I believe the harm is. So we try to focus on the harm because of that inability to recover as easily financially or from a mental health well-being perspective. But there will be things like self-neglect, like not feeding yourself as much because you're using your money to spend on scams. The phone ringing all of the time. Old school landline scams are still massive. So where we're moving into this, AI is going to be massively problematic for scams and fraud. The old methods, knocking on the door, ringing on your landline, they're still working really well for the criminals to be able to extract money and personal information from people. So it'll be things like the phone ringing all the time, talking about a new friend that you didn't know about, a change in behaviour, secrecy as well, particularly sometimes with older people. There is a fear factor as well that when somebody of a certain age is scammed, that their family members will then move in and take away their financial autonomy. So that needs to be managed as well. So where we're culturally very British, we don't talk about money. We don't talk about what we earn. We don't talk about our financial situations. We don't. It's not something that we do in our culture generally. If you're an American, you ask them what they earn, they'll tell you. It's not something that we shy away from. It seems to be an awkward conversation for us to have. So it has to be dealt with. You have to tread carefully without making somebody feel like you're going to take away their personal choice or their personal decisions. But there will be key markers. It is very much quite a listening role. So listen to what people don't say or what they're not telling you, and gently probe and ask those questions rather than going in hard, because it just makes people shut off. Particularly if there is that element of coercive control, because the criminals will say, and I've had it before where we've had victims who have been told that Trading Standards, the police, are trying to take your money. I'm going to protect it for you. Or your friends and family are jealous of your investment opportunities, and you will lose that investment opportunities if too many people hear about it. So there's all of this emotional language that the criminals will use, and they'll continually push you into a hot state so that you're not able to make objective decisions about what they're asking you to do.
Like knocking you off balance, putting you in that hot state, and then taking advantage of that. And what can we do, Lou, to kind of prevent some of this? We talked about identifying it. Are there things that everybody who works in financial services should have at their disposal or know about in regards to fraud and scams that perhaps they surprisingly don't know?
I think vulnerability is key to all of this stuff. Understanding consumer vulnerability, also understanding that quite often the world that we move in, especially from a financial sector perspective, the people that you sit next to at your desk are not a true reflection of the people that you're dealing with from a customer base. So we have such a huge amount of assumed knowledge, and we have to strip that all back. A piece of research we're just about to launch talks about people that are neurodivergent, and they're 50% more likely to be scammed than somebody that's neurotypical, because of the way that the fraud messaging and anti-fraud messaging is not landing with those people. There's also an overconfidence in identifying fraud and scams, and that's just one factor that could cause that vulnerability. So I think it's whilst it's a massive mountain to climb, it can happen to anybody, and I think we all need to have that in our minds. Strip away our bias as best we can. We judge people within 1 millisecond of meeting them. We have to unpick some of this stuff.
Mm, absolutely. It's and Lynn, last word. It's how are you now?
I'm absolutely fine. I now know don't do that. Don't do. And I'm much more conscious now of everything I do in how I buy things or where I buy things. I do consciously, and I'm very good at telling my friends, don't answer that, that's a scam, you know, much better at that.
It's kind of scams busting runs in the genes. Lynn and Luke, thank you ever so much.
And that was Lynn and Lou Baxter. If you'd like to find out more about Lou, she's on LinkedIn. But you can also search for National Trading Standard Scams Team for some key resources. And that's about it. So until next time, as they used to say on Crime Watch, ask your dad, don't have nightmares, do sleep well, and always remember that vulnerability matters. Vulnerability Matters was produced by Phil King and brought to you by the Money Advice Trust.